Hello, you're listening to a special podcast recorded at the 2013 British Humanist Association Conference in Leeds. This podcast was brought to you by The Pod Delusion, a weekly news magazine, radio programme and podcast about interesting things. From politics to culture to science, we look at all of these from a rationalist, humanist perspective. You can find out more about The Pod Delusion and listen to our weekly programme at poddelusion.co.uk. Now, in this podcast, we're going to be listening to author Christopher Priest. He's going to be talking about magic as a metaphor, and the metaphor for the reality, ingredients of literature, and a rational approach to the fantastic. Christopher Priest, you may know, is the award-winning author of The Prestige, which was later adapted into a successful Hollywood film directed by Christopher Nolan. Christopher Priest explores another way of seeing, exploring magic as a metaphor in literature and lifting the veil on taking a rational approach with the fantastic. So without further ado, here's Christopher Priest.
About a month ago, I was at the Magic Circle, the International Society of Magicians, where I'd been invited to judge their biannual competition to find the Stage Magician of the Year. I've only one claim on the world of magic, and that is a novel I wrote some 20 years ago, The Prestige, of which you've just heard a bit. This used magic as an extended metaphor for the act of writing. While being invited to the Magic Circle was an honour, it was also a huge pleasure, because magic, performed at the highest level, is always entertaining. Laughter is a constant accompaniment to most magic. The laughter of surprise, of being amazed, or simply the laughter that enjoys witty commentary. Magic is both fantastic and rational, a unique combination. It's fantastic because who could imagine a live dove being concealed inside an inflated balloon, let alone being produced from within it. But it's rational too, because every trick you see performed on stage has a carefully rehearsed technique behind it. My professional involvement with magic began when I started to write The Prestige. At that time, stage magic had no particular interest for me beyond something I wanted to write about. I imagined conjuring illusionism as a metaphor, a way of heightening the reality of fiction. Magic itself seems to improve on reality, or at least to change reality to the extent that you think you might be seeing in a different way. Last month, I watched as a man impaled himself on a metal spike, apparently without harm. A marked playing card turned up inside a sealed can of dog food. The dog was there. Ropes were cut in two, then magically rejoined. Almost every act included a moment when an endless stream of playing cards appeared seemingly from nowhere. So many of them that stagehands had to come on between the acts and sweep them away. Many of the tricks were ones we had all seen before, or ones like them. But it was impossible to see how any of them were done. We were taken in by it, and gladly. Of course, none of it was real, and that's part of the fun. Fiction, too, is untrue. We don't judge a novel by how true or accurate it is. We read it knowing that everything in it will be invented, and we applaud the author for the skill with which the lie is told, the plausibility we find in the made-up story, the way non-existent characters seem to come to life. We are thrilled by thrillers. We weep at weepies, and we let our imagination soar when we read of the fantastic. We are taken in by it, and gladly. Fiction is an extended metaphor, an improvement on, or variation of, mundane reality. This is what it shares with performance magic. A few years ago, the film version of The Prestige was released. If you saw it, you would have followed the story of two 19th century conjurers trying to destroy each other with their magical skills. The main actors were Hugh Jackman and Christian Bale, and the film was directed by Christopher Nolan. Other well-known actors who were in the film included Scarlett Johansson, Michael Caine, Rebecca Hall, Andy Serkis, and David Bowie. The following year, the film was nominated for two Academy Awards. Didn't win them. I'm often asked what I think of the film. My answer, which I believe is fairly unexpected, is that I rather liked it. Most book writers seem to complain about film adaptations of their work. The Prestige has several ingenious scenes which capture, with cinematic economy, several of the ideas or images from my novel. I think the complex narrative shape of the film is brilliant. For instance, in the first few minutes of the film, there are something like seven plot strands which are set out subtly and unobtrusively. They are obvious only if you see the film several times, as I have done. I do have some reservations about it, though. There are a few adapted scenes I don't agree with, but it would be tedious to go into them in detail now, so I won't. And I've always disliked the very end of the film. This takes the central mystery, which in the novel the reader was intended to solve as the book goes along, and it turns that mystery into a secret, a twist ending. You might or might not be taken in by the twist ending, but in either case, I think not gladly. This, for me, illustrates the difference between literature and film. Film is a literal medium. It depicts and defines, and it therefore guides and controls the imagination. Literature hints and suggests. The images are formed uniquely in the mind of the reader. The words of a book are like a code, stimulating the imagination when they are deciphered. Nothing is real or literal. Everything is metaphor. The film and the novel of The Prestige both have the same subjects, obsessive secrecy leading to obsessive curiosity. But that's just the surface. The rivalry of the two magicians was made literal in the film, and it no longer looked metaphorical to me. In losing the metaphor, we lost a level of reality, the imaginative reality. So let me talk about literature, or at least the branch of literature which I find most interesting, the fantastic. I've believed in the strength, beauty, and effectiveness of the fantastic ever since I began writing some 50 years ago. I'm not planning to change my mind in the few years ahead. The brand is popularly known as science fiction. I interpret the word science loosely, according to its original meaning. Science means knowledge. I work on the rational assumption that knowledge can be gained or discovered about almost any subject. There is knowledge to be found about people, about society, sex, war, love, games, history, politics, change, chaos. This is the sort of scientific process I understand, and that's what I write about. I began writing soon after I left school. I was born into a conventional English background. My father worked all his adult life for a company that made weighing machines, while my mother stayed at home to care for me and my two sisters. We were a nice, ordinary, bourgeois family with material values and practical aspirations. My parents had no discernible interest in the arts or literature. There were few books in the house when I was a child, and most of the ones that were there were mine. I was often in trouble for spending so much time reading them. I have no distinguished literary ancestors, close or distant. If this seems an unlikely background for a writer of fantastic literature, then think again. Although I blended in naturally with the grey and uninteresting reality around me, internally I was in rebellion. I yearned for better things. I was growing up in the aftermath of the Second World War, which had not only killed so many millions of people, it had inflicted tremendous physical and financial damage on my country. The people of my parents' generation look back to the years before the war as a kind of golden age, one which for them had comprehensible moral values, relative prosperity, and a stable society. It was an understandable view, but I always knew that there was more to life than a meek acceptance of those old-fashioned values. I was young, and I wanted to move on. Striving for something better is a characteristic of my post-war generation. The first hint of what was to come was at the beginning of the 1960s, just as we started to become adults. Rock and roll was spreading through the Western world. The peak of that was when the Beatles emerged. I'm almost exactly the same age as the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. Everyone in those days seemed to have their own dreams, some big, some small. I had a small plan. I wanted to outgrow my dull and suburban childhood and explore the world of the imagination. But you can never entirely throw off your background. My unexciting childhood has provided me with a rational point of view. I like everything to have an explanation, a reason. I like to understand. I believe in practical reality. It's the same conflict as I described before, the excesses of a fantastic imagination, restrained or partly restrained by a rational mind. As a teenager, I became attracted to American science fiction, which was then usually described as a literature of ideas. As soon as I started reading, I discovered this was true. And as a teenager with an open mind, I was impressed by the stimulating ideas of science fiction writers. This was a time when science fiction was starting to grow up. the days of the nubile young woman being chased by giant ants while she was wearing nothing more than a bikini and a goldfish bowl felt as if they were nearly over. They weren't, though. In fact, the sensational kind of science fiction never really appealed to me, not even when I was a teenager. I've always been serious about books. But for me, there has been a constant problem with science fiction. It can be characterised as the difference between the works of Isaac Asimov and J.G. Ballard. I was reading both writers at that time. I found that books by Isaac Asimov were long and unsubtle. They were interested in things that did not interest me. His characters were completely unbelievable, and in general, his books were written in a prose style I found difficult to follow. I kept having to go back and reread the previous paragraph because I thought I'd missed something. J.G. Ballard was also writing science fiction, but his plots were enigmatic and ambiguous, his characters highly stylized, his prose mysterious, beautiful, and obsessive. His ideas involved memory, identity, existence, time, entropy, art, surrealism. Once read, a Ballard story can never be forgotten. Of course, this is partly a matter of taste, and I realise that many people still think of Isaac Asimov as a classic writer. But back then, I had a point of view. I was a beginning writer, eager to learn, looking for examples to follow. In that sense, Isaac Asimov's fiction was a blind alley, a dead end, as was most American science fiction. It taught me nothing as a beginning writer. Asimov's writing was derivative in style, unironic, politically conservative, sociologically consensual. He wrote about technology, solutions, empires, commerce and power. He wrote about the future, but it was the sort of future I was desperately hoping to avoid. There was too much imperialism, too much reliance on the military, and a complete lack of sex. J.G. Ballard, though, was radical and risky. His work always left one with a wonderful sense of unanswered questions. He gave disturbing, unusual insights into the present day, and the future he dreamed about was one in which the images of Salvador Dali, the ideas of Marshall McLuhan, and the language of the space age would be employed. He wrote about randy research fellows, debauched doctors, and faded movie queens. I was eager to learn about writing, and Ballard's work was full of encouragement. I set my jacket off. Anymore. Thank you. Ballard's career is an interesting one. Since his death in 2009, he has become widely regarded as one of the most important British writers of the late 20th century. But it was not always so. He began writing in the late 1950s, and for a long time he was relatively obscure, his fiction known to what felt like a favoured few. I'm proud that I was one of those few. I read my first Ballard story in 1962, which was when I was getting interested in writing. Once I discovered his work, I spent much time trying to track down everything else he had written. In those days before Amazon and Abe Books, it was not so easy. As I found out more about this intensely private author, whom eventually I was to meet in person, certain facts about his background were gradually becoming known. He made no secret of what had happened to him, but to those of us intrigued by the astonishing material in his fiction, it felt as if clues might lie there, some kind of explanation for those haunting landscapes, the surreal imagery, the irrational behaviour of his characters, his obsessions with movie queens and randy doctors. Ballard's background was that he had been born of British parents in China and was living in Shanghai when the Second World War broke out. He and his family were interned in a Japanese prison camp for the duration. In 1984, J.G. Ballard finally confronted this formative experience head-on and published Empire of the Sun, the novel about his internment that was soon to become his best-known book. It also became a bestseller and was quickly snapped up to be filmed by Steven Spielberg. It starred Christian Bale, who 20 years later was coincidentally to appear in the film of my book, The Prestige. As an admirer of the author, I was pleased by all this, but I also noticed something else that was going on, which did surprise me. Empire of the Sun became news. By this I mean it became real news. There were stories about it on the radio and television, news bulletins, and also in the newspapers. Firstly, there was the phenomenon of a little-known British author suddenly, or so it seemed to most people, bursting forth with this amazing novel. But more than that, the book awakened memories of the Second World War in many people, including several of the ones who had been interned in Lungwa camp at the same time as the Ballard family. Some of these survivors, most of whom were clearly unfamiliar with Ballard's apocalyptic fiction, rushed to declare that life in the camp had been nothing like that. Mr. Ballard commented with some satisfaction that he knew he had broken the middle-class conspiracy of silence that had grown up around the events there. But there were also the book's revelations about the strange culture of the pre-war international settlement in Shanghai, which was not a colony, but a city occupied by thousands of non-Chinese and divided into areas of national concessions, French, American, and so on. It was largely westernised. His address in Shanghai was number 31 Amherst Avenue. Still there. All this changed with the violent arrival of the Japanese, and 3 years later with the return of the Americans. This book was news. I suppose I shouldn't have been surprised. Books are always in the news, and in fact they are newsworthy more often than many people seem to think. We remember, of course, the sensational threats in 1989 against Salman Rushdie over his novel The Satanic Verses. The year before the Ayatollah's fatwa, the news had been full of the Spycatcher affair, a book in which the author Peter Wright claimed to have exposed a Soviet spy in the highest echelons of MI5. When I started my first job in London in 1959, the hot news topic of the time was the belated publication of a novel written more than 30 years earlier. It had last been released in Britain, and the publishers were being prosecuted under the Obscene Publications Act. That book was, of course, D.H. Lawrence's novel Lady Chatterley's Lover. Again and again, books and the consequences of them break into the news. Recent examples have been the publication of biographies of Margaret Thatcher, Martin Amis's attack on Islam, Stella Rimington's memoirs of her time as Director General of MI5, the memoirs of Margaret Cook, former wife of the then Foreign Secretary, and many, many other examples. For instance, the major literary awards, the Man Booker Prize, the Women's Prize for Fiction, the Costa Book Awards are always discussed on the news pages. Small stories get into the news too. Once you start noticing, you realise that books provide a constant background to what is going on in the world. About a month ago, when I found out I would be attending this conference today, I started scanning the news for anything that related to books or writers. I emphasised that I was looking in the news pages, not in the arts or literary supplements. It's been a fairly quiet period, but even so, at least every other day, one book or writer has come into the spotlight. It would obviously be time-consuming to list them all, but here are about a quarter of them. For instance, yesterday on the train coming up to Leeds, I read in the news pages that Tom Sharp had died, the creator of the Porterhouse Blue and other novels, I suppose he was really in the tradition of Woodhouse. This week it was announced that the new sponsor for the Women's Prize for Fiction is to be Baileys, who make the cream liqueur. The winner this year is the American writer A.M. Holmes for her novel May We Be Forgiven. The footballer Frank Lampard has published his first book, A Tale for Children, although Mr. Lampard did explain that he hadn't actually written it himself. He had substantial help. David Goodhart, author of a book about immigration, complained that he had not been invited to the Hay Literary Festival. I wasn't invited either, but I'm not complaining. The poetry publisher Salt revealed that it can no longer afford to publish single author collections. The chairman of the Manila Development Authority wrote an open letter to the author Dan Brown, complaining about the description in his new novel, Inferno, of Manila as the gates of hell. The US short story writer Lydia Davis won the Man Booker International Prize, ahead of 9 other contenders from around the world. Amazon Co. UK, which accounts for 41% of the UK book market, is constantly in the news at the moment for not paying enough tax, or at least not paying enough tax here. Vicky Price, the ex-wife of Chris Hume, released from prison, is going to write a book about her experiences to be published in September. It's said that her ex, Chris Hume, might also be seeking a publishing deal. And so much, incidentally, for the principle that criminals should not profit from being incarcerated. The writing and publishing of books, which sometimes seems like the Cinderella of the arts, is therefore not just important in itself, but it continues to have relevance in the modern world. I've been involved in literature for half a century, and in all that time, one thing has never changed. Voices are always raised to warn of the disappearance of books and the death of literature. My first attempt at public speaking was at the Harrogate International Literary Festival in 1969. Most of those proceedings took the form of a public debate about the imminent death of books, how technology was likely to destroy them, what might arise to replace them. We heard many fanciful ideas, including the telepathic transmission of text direct into the reader's brain, miniature homunculi being trained to act out the stories, and so on. Many other similar kinds of whimsy. The one thing everyone agreed on was that some kind of electronic device displaying the words on the screen would soon be invented, and this would instantly replace the printed book. Well, it took about four more decades, but we've had had Amazon's Kindle and other handheld digital devices for 2 or 3 years now, a period in which the sales of books have actually increased. In 2012, overall sales by British publishers, including both digital and printed books, increased by 4% to some £3.3 billion. That's hardly the sign of an industry in decline. Books are now cheaper than ever. Digital books sell for prices that are barely credible. For example, F. Scott Fitzgerald's best novel, The Great Gatsby, which has just been filmed, can be bought today from Amazon in its digital version for just 77 pence. Even a new copy of the printed paperback of the same title can be bought for £1.98. Hardbacks, too, are much less expensive than popular belief would have it. My own new novel, The Adjacent, published next week in a handsome hardback. There's only one copy here, and it's priced at £12.99. What else can you buy for £12.99? It probably wouldn't cover the cost of a single main course in a halfway decent restaurant. It certainly wouldn't buy you a meal in this place. My previous novel, which is called The Islanders, came out from the same publishers 2 years ago. That was priced at £13.99. The novel I've already mentioned a couple of times, The Prestige, appeared in hardback in 1995. And at that time, 18 years ago, it was priced at £15.99. Are books actually becoming cheaper? Like all authors, I'm never consulted by the publishers about such matters as pricing, so I'm in the dark about practicalities. But if nothing else, this astonishing fact seems to me to suggest one more way in which books and literature are unique in our culture. In 1946, George Orwell, writing about what he saw as the canard that books are an expensive luxury, wrote, If our book consumption remains as low as it has been, at least let us admit that it is because reading is a less exciting pastime than going to the dogs, the pictures, or the pub, and not because books are too expensive. Let me return to rationalism. As I have said, fiction is not judged by how true it is, but how well the story is told, or how finely the author writes, or by the originality of the text. If realism is involved, then the fiction will be judged on how likely the realism seems, not how real it is. I'm concerned here, as in my daily life at home, with fantastic literature. The rule of unreliability applies to all fiction, of course, even though some people assume that by its very nature, the fantastic must be imaginary. What are the writer's motives for choosing to tell a story against a background that cannot be real, or at least is less real-seeming than the world in which the reader is reading? A love story set 10 years in the future is still a love story. How do the 10 years of an unknown future change that? An adventure, a quest for something, a search for someone can happen anywhere. Why set it on a planet at the other end of the universe? We assume that the writer must have felt that there was more to it than wishing to tell a story. Some kind of extra point was being made. Perhaps the writer saw this future world or the distant planet not as settings to be taken literally, but as extended metaphors for something we might recognise in our own lives. By invoking the fantastic, the writer is drawing attention not to the familiar, but to the unfamiliar. The reader is therefore invited to think. In fact, the reader has to think. A rational process is going on. Literature is a form of entertainment, but the best books, involve the reader's mind too. So what is the reader made to think about? In most cases, the fantastic deals with the results of a process. It might be the elapse of time. 10 years in the future is just one example. The writer might simply be saying, look, this could happen. This is a warning. Or perhaps a promise. Things are going to be much worse than they are now, or slightly better. Fantastic literature therefore requires an extra factor. In most cases, it suggests that an act or a decision has taken place. The story deals with the consequences of that act or decision. As we know, decisions can be deliberate, insane, calculated, misguided, or inspired, but they are usually the result of some kind of rational thought. For example, the monster in Mary Shelley's novel Frankenstein, published in 1818, was the result of a decision. This now familiar story was one of the first novels of the rational fantastic. A scientist, Victor Frankenstein, who makes the decision to build the monster, faces the consequences of what he has done. Shelley's novel is therefore inherently about the scientific process and the responsibility for what follows. These days, responsibility is not the domain just of scientists. Politicians are responsible for many things. So are armies, big industries, religious fanatics of every stripe, manufacturers of landmines and smart bombs and pilotless drones, people who pollute the sea or the atmosphere, people who fracture the body of the earth in the search for gas and quick profits, terrorists and armed militia, people who think laws are made for everybody else, people who put money first or who try to resolve disagreements with violence. All literature deals with these subjects. But a writer interested in the speculative can use fantastic metaphors to demonstrate results that extend far beyond the immediate world. The rational argument becomes larger. It has a universal application, bigger than countries, bigger than economic blocs, bigger than military alliances. The general novel can, of course, contain actions or decisions with consequences for which the characters become responsible. The point I'm trying to make is that only in the modern speculative novel, with its rational use of fantastic metaphors, is responsibility for one's actions the core, the real argument, the essential message. When ideas are ignored, or when thinkers are crushed, a vacuum is created. The tyrants move in to fill it. Tyranny, extremism, ignorance, bullying, repression, exploitation can only exist when the human imagination is suppressed. The true answer to tyrants is the use of human imagination, the refusal to stop thinking, the insistence on metaphors, the love of daydreams. I hold as essential the belief that books are one of the few effective remedies left to us. Literature should express ideas, should in its quiet but compelling way defy tyrants and governments and people with absolute or extreme agendas. That it should speak directly to the reader and provide entertainment and provocation in equal measure. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Some really thought-provoking ideas there, weren't there? I was reminded of the thought that the pictures are better on the radio. Well, the pictures are even better in books, aren't they, where we don't even have the constraint of time. And the power of books to draw our attention to different things has been vividly expressed here. We've got about half an hour now for questions and answers, so if anyone would like to ask a question, please just raise your hand. Okay, there's one over there. Shout out loud and I'll repeat the question.
Well, it's not really a question, I'm afraid. I just feel compelled, I'm sorry, to do a hooray for Isaac Asimov. He was a massive inspiration to me as a teenager, and I had a totally different reaction for a priest who's Asimov's work. I'm also not very hard to get anything about sex published in the pre-Lady Catherine. If anybody wants to sort of commune with my hooray towards Isaac Asimov, I have
okay, thank you so much. And I'm very happy that this shouldn't be restricted to questions. I think comments, discussions are fine. So in case you didn't all hear, that was a real plug for Isaac Asimov and how it wasn't fair on him that sex wasn't published in those days, and he was inspirational to many. Any other questions? Yes, here. Thank you, with the beard, yes.
So I've got children 14, 13, and But they're also all very interested in YouTube. Should I be worried?
Okay, so did you all hear that? Children of 14, 13 and 3 are interested in books, but even more interested in YouTube. Should the questioner be worried?
Should we be worried? No, of course not. I mean, it's the more diverse children's interests are, the better. But I remember a few years ago, I went to a wedding in South Wales. We had to leave before the bridegroom's speech because we had to get back to where I live before midnight because the new Harry Potter book was being published. And my two children, who then were, I suppose, about 14 or 15, there was just no way they wouldn't buy it at the time. We went to the Waterstones in our local shopping centre, and there was a queue which stretched right across the shop in a zigzag, right out into the shopping mall, down the side, back again, and about three times across the shopping mall. And opposite, there was a similar queue going in and out of WH Smith. And that's one of the most heartening things I've ever seen, the fact that a book was so important to so many kids across such a diverse population spread. But they were all using YouTube. They can read books too.
Yes, yeah.
Christopher, I'm a reader, so I know all about the pleasure of the text. You're a writer. What's the pleasure in it for you?
So did you hear the question? This is a reader who knows about the pleasure of the text. He wants to ask Christopher, as a writer, what's the pleasure?
It's the same as yours. I love reading books. I spend more time reading than I do writing. It's less hard work.
But then when you're writing, are you a... the pleasure of the ideas. Have you got the reader in mind, how he'll react to the pleasure of your text? Or you don't consider the reader when you're actually writing?
Writing is two things at once. One is expression. You say what you've come to say. And the other is communication to the reader. So they balance. I mentioned homunculi. I have a homunculi of my own who sits behind my computer screen, and he laughs at all my jokes and gets upset, you know, that sort of thing. So I write for him in the first instance. I don't really have a conception of the readers. I really write for this generalised idea of a reader, but there's no answer to it, really. It's you know, it's how do you blow your nose? It's sort of, it's something you do.
Thank you. Question at the back there.
Yes. You talked extensively about the books of fiction. Do you consider the Bible to be one?
Do you consider the Bible to be a book of fiction?
I feel I've just been given a really hot potato.
So the full question, Christopher asked me to repeat the question. So the full question was about the Bible, that Christopher had spoken about the importance of fiction and the liberation and opportunity it gives to make people think. And then the question is the Bible an effective work of, or a work of fiction at all?
I suppose in this environment I can say what I really think, which is it's obviously a book of propaganda. It's true in the sense that the writers who wrote it meant it to be true, but I felt they were seriously misguided. One of the most interesting books I read was Ludovic Kennedy's book, which he wrote towards the end of his life, which was, he just read the Bible three times and discussed it as literature and as polemic and as a reporting of certain alleged facts. And, I agreed entirely with that. I was just interested in the particular matter of the Gospels. I've always been interested in the Gospels as literature, and they were all written basically to create churches. They weren't created to spread the word, as they seem to be. And I've always felt very suspicious of that. It's a political thing rather than a spiritual thing.
Thank you. Yes, here. Do you want to shout?
You've dismissed the Bible, rather. I mean, Why is the Bible such a powerful book?
So the question was, why is the Bible such a powerful book? Where else were there questions? And I'll get the microphone to you ready. Yes, there's one just there.
Search me. I mean, that's the I've no idea. I did religious instruction at school. I found it boring, and I couldn't believe any of it. I liked some of the stories, you know, the prodigal son and that sort of thing, but I accepted them as stories. And I think that there are certain aspects of all religions which are interesting. For instance, the Christian creed of forgiveness is very important, and it's something which works on a practical level, but it doesn't mean you have to sign up for everything else. And I've read a lot about Islam, which in its purest form is very similar to Christianity in its aspirations, but the way it's interpreted by its followers obviously is another matter. And I don't know. I'm totally unreligious. I'll tell you how it feels for me. I'm not interested in football. Now, people think that because I'm not interested in football, I'm against football. And I'm not against football. If people want to go to football matches, I don't care. But I'm not going to stand outside a football stadium and yell at them.
a character...
Like, and then after that...
All right.
Yes.
Start again.
So this one.
Okay. A character in Robertson Davies' novel, The Manticure, which I suspect you read and reread, as it's about conjuring, of course, said that there is a time when one must be strong with rationalists, for they can reduce anything whatever to dust if they happen not to like the look of it, or if it threatens their deep-buried negativism. In what specific ways can we give a more positive view of life?
I'll try and summarise it. So it's about the allegation that rationalists can reduce anything to dust if they want to, and how can we give a more positive view of life?
A few years ago, I was living in Wiltshire, and every summer, crop circles would appear in the fields there. It was a big local story, and there was one which was a famous crop circle. It ended up on the cover of an LP by Led Zeppelin. It was a huge one. It's about a mile from where I lived, and the day after it appeared, I went out and looked at it and was able to walk around it. I found it fascinating. The close detail that you find in a crop circle is quite unbelievable. What's the rational explanation for that? And you can try. It's the one I saw was under some overhead wires, you know, there was something going across the field, so it didn't look as if it had come down from above. I mean, the usual explanation, rational explanation for them these days is that it's artists, that it's people who go out with planks and ropes and things in the middle of the night and trample it down. But frankly, I don't buy that. I mean, have you ever tried walking around a field in the night? It's, you know, it's to do something as precise and delicate as the kind of things, like there was one near Cambridge which was a Mandelbrot set laid out in a field of wheat, and it was really beautiful, and you can't think how rationally how that could have been done. So although I am a rationalist and I try to find a rational explanation for everything, there are some things which you can't explain. And by the way, I love Robertson Davies books.
Okay, here, and then the lady in the green after that. Yes, thank you.
In your list of authors, you failed to mention Ray Bradbury. Is there a reason for that?
Ray Bradbury, yeah. Didn't you?
There's about 14,000 others I failed to mention. how long have you got? the thing about Ray Bradbury is he died, was it this year or late last year? He died quite recently. I read his books when I was a teenager, along with all the other American writers that I was reading then. I found him really magical. But then a few years later, I looked back and they didn't work for me anymore. I felt they were a bit twee. But I think by then my taste has become rather sophisticated. I don't know. I loved him when I was younger.
Thank you. This is an anecdote which was prompted to, back to my memory from one of the earlier questions, and it occurred this year in...
Just shout and I'll repeat it.
At the Edinburgh International Science Festival, which takes place every year in April.
Is that working?
And the group leader stopped outside this building and he said, can anyone name the most important person in fiction? He was hoping somebody would say Sherlock Holmes because he was about to tell us that Conan Doyle had studied here. But the voice from the back of the group said, Jesus. That was a very sharp intake of
So did you all hear the comment about who's the most important figure in fiction, and it was decided it was Jesus, even in Calvinist Edinburgh. There was another question here, please. Here? Yes, thank you. Do you want to comment on Jesus being fiction? No, okay.
Is that right? I've been running a book group for many years where we meet once a month to talk about the book, usually fiction, that we have read. And we have had the idea that if it's available in film form, we will try to have both. And there came a time where one person hadn't managed to read the book, which was Atonement. She didn't realise that there are two alternative endings, and she was right out of the main part of the discussion. And you did talk about the difference between a book and the film. Do you think that fits in?
So I don't think the microphone was fully working. Person runs a book group, and they try and see the films of the books they discuss as well as the, reading the book if a film exists. But a recent discussion about Atonement, one of the participants had seen only the film. She hadn't had time to read the book. And this excluded her from much of the discussion, such as the two alternative endings in the book. So does Christopher have comments further to what he already said about the kind of difference between a book and the film of the book?
What I was getting at in the talk was that the filmmaking is essentially a different activity from book writing. And although I understand why a book group would want to see the film, I think the book is always the dominant form. That doesn't mean I think film is a subsidiary form. It's only the storytelling aspect of it, if it's adapted from a book. In general, a book adaptation in film uses about 1/8 of the book. It's quite, you know, it's quite unusual for more of the book to go in. So you're not going to get more than a general overview of the novel, even with an accurate film dramatization. I mean, I mentioned the film of Great Gatsby, which has just come out, and that is, again, it's not like the book, although it's based on the book. And I can't comment on Atonement because I happen to loathe that novel. I know most people like it. Yeah, I should have added that I've been invited to two or three book groups locally where I live, and it's not an experience I've enjoyed. They go for you.
Wes, while the microphone's reaching the next question, do you feel that film is a more passive medium? That's part of it, whereas reading a book is much more active.
Well, I think everyone who I've always said, and I believe, and I believe this really truly, that the act of reading is as creative as the act of writing, that the only two people who matter in literature are the writer and the reader. And the reason for that is that when you read a book, what you see in your mind, I mean, Tricia said the pictures are better on the radio. Pictures are even better in books. But the image you get from a book when you're reading is unique. You're the only person in the world at that moment reading that page. You know, even if you're reading a bestseller, you're never reading the same words at the same time. And even if you were, you'd never meet the person who's reading those words at the same time as you. So the book is a very personal, direct, intimate experience. But film is a collective thing. You sit in an audience and you all laugh at the same time. And as I was saying in the talk, the images are defined for you. What you see on the screen.
I touched it.
Hello. I don't think film is a subsidiary form at all. I mean, the amount of money they spent, the money they spent on making The Prestige was $39 million. You know, you could run a town on that.
Okay, do you want to shout? Yes.
Yes. I was going to stick up for the movies, but I'll be. Can I ask you about some of the relationship between speculative fiction and religion? Because two books I'm thinking of from maybe some of the same era were C.S. Lewis's Perelandra series, which was written from an overtly religious perspective, and also a book that I still think is wonderful, which is Frank Herbert's Dune, which actually was a critique of religion, and not only of religion, but of the relationship between politics and religion. And I can't think of another medium in which, at that time, or 1965, that could be dealt with that kind of breadth and scope.
Did everyone hear that? The gentleman talked about the Perelandra stories by C.S. Lewis and Dune by Frank Herbert as being largely describing the building of a religion. Would you say that? Is that what you said? Yes. Well, this is a moment of great confession, which is I've never read Dune, so I saw the film. But the C.S. Lewis books, the Out of the Silent Planet and Voyage to Venus, I think the second one, and That Hideous Strength, I think. Is this working?
Yes.
Yeah. The third one was called That Hideous Strength. They were actually amongst the first speculative fiction I ever read. I had no idea that it was about religion. I thought it was about going to other planets and discovering things. And it was only a lot later that I discovered what his motives have been. I think, you know, if I can use the phrase, I think literature is a broad church. You know, it's open to everyone. I've got nothing against religion. I'm just not interested in churches, you know, and the establishment of a church is what seems to follow religion, and I think that's what concerns people. I mean, we don't mind people believing crazy things. But I don't think speculative fiction has any particular... for instance, the stories by Anthony Trollope, where, you know, the Warden, the Barchester Towers, they were essentially about churchmen. So it was they were social comedies as well, but they had religion as a background. So it's not exclusive to speculative fiction. But I'm afraid I'm not very good on religion.
Another one there in the black T-shirt with the dress.
I'll shout.
Okay, try shouting. And then who would like to be next? So we get... Okay, at the front, sorry.
Like you, I was also an avid reader of science fiction when I was a teenager, and... thank you. And I took a lot of my collection away to university with me when I went, and the English major girlfriend I acquired in my first year wasn't in the least bit impressed by this, and she did actually make it her mission to introduce me to proper literature. Do you think science fiction is now considered proper literature, and if it isn't, do you care?
Everyone hear that? I never read science fiction. I read it when I was a teenager and then grew out of it. The one thing I took from it was this idea of the speculative metaphor. And that's the work I've been doing. A lot of my work is published as science fiction, but that's because the publishers have to do something with it. But it's not something I'm not up to date on it at all. I'm out of date on science fiction. I haven't read any for years. I don't know what I think of it. That's the answer to your question. Every now and then I review for The Guardian, and they will send me books by Adam Roberts, and I don't like those, and he gets really upset. He's a friend of mine, you know. Or he was.
So perhaps to extend the question a bit to speculative fiction, do you feel that speculative fiction is in some way different from proper fiction that an English major might want to promote?
Well, in many ways, all fiction is speculative, but there's a difference between, let's say, Atonement, which the gentleman talked about, which is a novel set partly in the 1930s and partly in the Second World War, and a novel which is set on Venus 2,000 years in the future. There's clearly a difference of some kind. And you can't say that one is worse than or better than the other. They're different. But then the word novel means new. And so every novel should be, you start at page one and you enter that world. And you accept it on the terms that the writer sets out. If you don't like it, stop reading. But I don't think there's any particular... for me, there's only one kind of book I want to write. That is with a speculative thing, because for me it's an ultimately very serious thing, and I'm very serious in a very ponderous sort of way. But that's not in any way to diminish other people's... what they want to write.
You mentioned briefly how war can go into writing. I've just left the army and graduated in neuropsychology, and I plan to write a book about morality, combining those experiences. And I was just wondering, is there a particular process that you go through when you sit down to write? Because I feel it's going to be one hell of a daunting task.
Yeah, I don't want to go on too much about that, because I've had a good life and it's easy. But it's difficult writing, and you can't just sort of pick up a computer and get going. For me, war is a subject. I mean, the adjacent is about war, and I wrote 1299, a real snip. I wrote a novel a few years ago called The Separation, which was about specifically about the Second World War and the fact that it could have ended in 1941 if Churchill had gone that way. He didn't, and the war continued. So that to me seems a great a tragedy, actually, that the war could have ended and we had the chance to stop it. So I wrote a novel about it. I've got grave misgivings about all military activity. I mean, I'm absolutely appalled by the present government's intention of selling weapons to Syria.
Thank you. Any more questions? Well, where's the microphone at the moment? Okay, the front here, please. There's two here.
You may not have read them, but feminism took me into reading Ursula Le Guin and other women writers at that time. I wondered if you had read them and if you had any thoughts on those women writers.
Yeah, I love The Left Hand of Darkness. It's one of my favourite novels. And you read her for feminist reasons. I read her for male reasons, you know. She's a good writer. And there's another one of hers which I particularly like called The Dispossessed, which is a political novel. I'll read anything, actually, so long as it's challenging and new and well-written. And I would say that I read as many women writers as I do men, and not realising I'm doing it, if you see what I mean, not reading one rather than the other. Feminism is it's one of those subjects which recurs. During the 1970s, there was a huge feminist movement in the science fiction world. People like Le Guin in particular came to the fore, and there were other writers like James Tiptree Jr., who was a pseudonym for a woman, Vonda McIntyre, Joanna Russ, some very strong, interesting, good writers. And then that sort of died. It kind of went quiet. But in the last 2 or 3 years, there's been a resurgence of feminist writers appearing, in which, of course, I haven't read. But not for that reason, but for the reason I generally don't read science fiction.
But yes.
I'd like to make a comment about what you said a few minutes ago, that nobody ever reads the same page at the same time as somebody else. I was travelling on the tube in the 1970s and always had a book with me to read. I was rereading War and Peace, and I saw that next day our neighbour was also reading War and Peace, and we were on the same page.
But she was reading in Russian.
And I suppose we all remember at school when we all as a class read the same page of the same book out loud together. I don't know what you feel about actually reading together as a community, not necessarily at school, in a book group or in some other way, you know, often like poets read their stuff out loud and we all read it with them.
I think the important thing with reading is just to keep being diverse and experimenting. It doesn't matter if you read the most obvious bestseller. Your reading of it will be in the context of everything else you've read, not in the context of anyone else's, so that your reading of it will always be different. Every book you read leaves a mark on you. And it's always a new, unique experience, even if you buy the new Harry Potter book or 50 Shades of whatever the colour was.
I would argue that monotheistic religion belongs to the same set of ideologies tending towards totalitarianism. As a speculative novelist, would you have difficulty imagining what would fill the vacuum in a future society that had done away with religion?
Love to do it. I think that basically what life is about is the knowledge we're all going to die, and some people deal with that one way. I know humanists deal with it in a very practical, it's my own way, which is you only get one shot at this, and when you've gone, you're gone. But a lot of people are frightened of death, and they fear this oblivion that awaits us all. And religion seems to provide an answer to that. And I can't see that that will ever be sort of factored out of the human psyche. That need will always be there for many people.
Thank you for letting me have a second go. And I'm delighted that we've got a common point there. Like, I'm a huge lifelong fan of The Left Hand of Darkness, so we're not really at different ends of the spectrum. My question is a sort of question, is about film adaptations. And I'm really pleased that you like your film adaptation of, what's it called? The Prestige, that's it. Sorry. You said that a lot of authors don't. I've had cause to think about film adaptations of novels recently. And I think that there is actually, filmmaking and book writing are very, very different arts. And I'm not sure whether authors that have their books made into films sometimes sort of think this through properly. And when you're reading a book, you can stop and you can think about all the ideas in it, and then you can carry on reading 10 minutes later. Or if you find that there's a reference to a character and you think, who is this person, you can then flick back 5 chapters. Whereas in a film, everything just flashes past you and you stop to think, you've lost the plot, and you think, who's that character? Well, nobody's going to tell you. I think maybe a good film of a novel would actually put in space at difficult points, or would remind you consciously of who the characters are. And maybe the bad films of novels are the ones where the filmmaker hasn't actually thought this through and doesn't do this. And the good films of novels, nobody actually realises what they've done because it simply works and everyone says, oh, this is a really good film of the novel. So I'm wondering if perhaps film adaptations are a bit like housework, that nobody notices them unless somebody does them badly. I mean, I wonder whether you've consciously thought through the difficulties the filmmaker of your novel had and what your comments are on that generally. Thank you.
Thank you. I could give you a really long answer on that, but one of the things that happens in The Prestige, how many people saw the film? Quite a lot of you. Yeah, you see. It's actually quite a good film, so I'm not doing that, but I said in the talk that there are certain things I disagreed with. And in the book, one of the magicians has this woman working with him, and she gets sick of the feud between the two men, as women often do, and she says, I'm going to sort this out, and she goes off and infiltrates herself in the other camp, as it were, to try and resolve the issue. And in the film, they turn this round. The character, played by Hugh Jackman, tells his woman to go and do it, go and shack up with the other guy and find out what his secrets are. Now, I found this completely offensive, because it totally reversed the morality of the scene that I had written. And I sat there when the first time I saw the film, I actually broke out in that legendary cold sweat. I felt they'd really blown the story, because it was such an important moment in the story. But because it was a film, immediately after that scene, there was somebody on a train, and then sometime after that, there was something else, and we didn't get back to that part of the story for about 10 minutes, because all sorts of things happened in the meantime. So the betrayal was completely forgotten. I mean, nobody but me would have noticed it, because, you know, the films sweep you on, and that is part of it. It's a parade that goes before you. You can't take it all in. And in many ways, filmmakers don't want you to think. They don't want you to go back, no, is this the character who said, as you do in the book, you know, in the book, as you say, you're always referring back to sort of catch up with what the author intended. But with a film, they don't want you to. I hereby announce there's going to be another film of one of my books called The Glamour. I don't know if anyone's ever heard of The Glamour. But the Glamour is a novel about invisibility, and it's the invisible people in the book are actually real, in the sense that they are real people, but they're rather boring looking, and so nobody ever notices them. so they live on the fringes of society. They're a kind of outcasts. They can't ever buy anything, so they have to steal. They've all got rotten teeth because they can't go to the dentist, because the dentist never gets to see them. They're all hypochondriacs because they can't get medicine. And so they're a rather paranoid outsider group. They're the sort of people... There's about five of them in the room, but you haven't noticed them. But this is going to be filmed next year by a man called Gerald McMorrow, who made a film a couple of years ago called Franklin. Nobody's ever seen Franklin. It was a real film. It's properly budgeted. Her film stars. It had people like Susanna York and... Eva Green was in it. And it was an extremely good film. And he's now going to move on to The Glamour. And we are just about to sign the contract, and he's going to start shooting next year. You heard it here first. I think I'm really being risky doing this, because these things always go wrong as soon as you tell people before it's definite. But I think this is going to happen. I don't know where... I'm bumbling away here. I'm sorry. Have I answered your question?
Well, I just want to have you all share with me in thanking Christopher Priest for a fascinating discussion, both of his own philosophy and where he comes from in writing books, and the whole role of books, and particularly fantastic literature. I found it enormously thought-provoking and entertaining. So many, many thanks, Christopher. And don't forget, there are several of his books available outside, including The Adjacent.
Thank you for listening to this special podcast brought to you by The Pod Delusion. You can find out more about The Pod Delusion on our website at poddelusion.co.uk, where you can also listen to our weekly programme.